Well, I thought it might be appropriate this evening to consider for a few moments what a Christian is, to address this question. What is a Christian? We have just witnessed Gigi being baptized, and the reason, of course, that she has been baptized is because she has become a Christian. But some of you may be sitting there thinking, well, I don't really know what that means. Is it that Gigi has simply taken up some new hobby? Is it that she's got herself involved in some kind of weird superstition or magic or something? Is it that she has renounced her native culture and become a Westerner? Is it that she has simply committed herself to some kind of new lifestyle? What does it mean? What is a Christian? Well, I want to try to answer that question, to some extent at least, by thinking for a few moments about this passage that we read earlier on, Luke chapter 18 and verses 9 to 14. The passage contains a parable which Jesus told. The parable has two characters. One, the Pharisee whose attitude Jesus is warning against, and the other, a tax collector whose attitude Jesus is commending. And it seems to me that from this second character then, the tax collector, and particularly from the way in which he contrasts with the first character, the Pharisee, we can learn quite a bit about what a Christian is. And so I just want to notice quickly four things this evening. First of all, the Christian's background. The Christian's background. What type of background does a Christian have? Well, the answer to that question is, it's irrelevant. The Christian's background is irrelevant. You see, if you were working on the basis of backgrounds, you would expect this parable to have the exact opposite outcome from the one which it does have. You would expect the Pharisee to emerge in a very positive light, and you'd expect the tax collector to emerge in a very negative light. Because Pharisees, you see, they were a very strict, highly religious Jewish sect. Pharisees were widely respected as principled men who exercised a good and moralizing influence upon society. Tax collectors, on the other hand, they were men who extracted money from their fellow Jews on behalf of the enemy, the Roman occupiers. The Romans at this time were occupying Palestine. And tax collectors were working for them, extracting money from their fellow Jews. Tax collectors were generally ostracized. They were perceived as corrupt compromisers whose main, if not only, interest in life, whose only consideration really was finance and money. And in terms of background then, as I say, this second character, the tax collector, he has absolutely nothing going for him whatsoever. He is absolutely a non-starter. I suppose that if he were a female prostitute, or if he were a demon-possessed person, then he might just be perceived as a little bit more disreputable than he was perceived. But not much. You couldn't get much lower in this society than a tax collector. And so in terms of his background, he had absolutely nothing going for him. And yet, you see, on this day, as he goes up to the temple, as he enters, in other words, the presence of God, it's irrelevant, isn't it? It has absolutely no bearing whatsoever. Other factors are hugely significant, and we'll come to those in a moment. But as for his perceived standing, his perceived status within first century Jewish society, it simply didn't enter into the equation at all. God wasn't interested in that. He didn't ask him about it. He didn't take it into account. That wasn't a factor. And it's still the same this evening. It's still the same. As I mentioned in my prayer, those of us in this room tonight who are Christians, who are believers in Jesus Christ, we come from all kinds of different backgrounds. I couldn't have stood up here tonight and spoken about my birthplace, Nepal. I couldn't have referred to a point when I was studying in Aberdeen and visiting Newcastle. These things aren't true of me. And yet, I have the same Saviour as Gigi. We believe in the same Jesus Christ. We're both Christians. And it's the same replicated then throughout this congregation. Where you have Christians here tonight, you have people from different backgrounds. And that means, for you tonight, if you're not a Christian, that you can become one whoever you are. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter where you come from. It doesn't matter what education you do or don't have. It doesn't matter what job you do or don't have. It doesn't matter what kind of area you live in, what kind of domestic situation you have. Those things are irrelevant. When you come to God through his Son Jesus Christ, he doesn't take those things into account. And you then, tonight, whatever your background, to exactly the same extent as this tax collector, with his terrible background, you can become a Christian. So that's the first important thing then. The Christian's background, it's irrelevant. Second thing that emerges here, the Christian's self-evaluation. The Christian's self-evaluation. What then is the Christian's self-evaluation? Well, basically, it's the same as the tax collectors in this parable, which we have at the end of verse 13. God have mercy on me, a sinner. A sinner. The tax collector evaluated himself as a sinner. And the Christian evaluates himself as a sinner. He sees himself, in other words, as someone who has fallen short of the requirements of the God who created him. He sees himself as someone who has defied the one who, as his maker, has absolute authority over him. He sees himself as a sinner. Now, I just want to ask two questions about this. First question, why did the Pharisee in this parable have a different self-evaluation? Why did the Pharisee have a different self-evaluation? And I want to give two answers to that question. First answer, because the Pharisee was comparing himself with other people. He was comparing himself with other people. You see that quite blatantly, don't you, as he begins his prayer in verse 11. God, I thank you that I am not like other men. Robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. In other words, when the Pharisee came to evaluate himself, his mind immediately went to that childhood friend of his. He had grown up with this lad. He had played with him. He had learnt with him. Their lives had been virtually inseparable right up until teenage years. But then in teenage years, they had drifted apart somewhat. And eventually, they had lost contact altogether. And the Pharisee never heard anything more of him until one day he had read in his newspaper that this childhood friend of his had been convicted in a court of law of serious robbery. His mind, when he came to self-evaluation, immediately went to that chap. And it also immediately went to another fellow, three doors up the street, who just recently had been discovered sleeping with someone else's wife. And this man was married and had children. and had been caught committing adultery. Whenever this Pharisee came to evaluate himself, his mind immediately shot off to all these different cases. And as he thought of these people, he began to feel pretty good about himself. Well, I've never been involved in serious robbery. I've never slept with someone else's wife. I must be pretty holy. I must be pretty good. I must be pretty pure and self-controlled. And perhaps you're engaging in that kind of comparison with other people tonight. It's always very tempting, isn't it? Because at the end of the day, however bad you are, you can always find somebody worse, can't you? You can always find someone who's more corrupt and more immoral and more depraved. You can always find material somewhere that will give you some kind of ego boost. But the problem is, you see, that God doesn't require us simply to do better than the alcoholic next door neighbor. He doesn't require us simply to outshine the sexually promiscuous colleague at work. God requires us to keep His law perfectly, fully, absolutely, in all its details. God doesn't say to us, I want you to be holy to a greater degree than some other people you know are holy. He says to us, I want you to be holy as I am holy. And the tax collector, you see, he understood that. It's very interesting in the Greek. It's not actually, have mercy on me, a sinner. It's have mercy on me, the sinner. It's the definite article. Now, of course, at one level, that's incorrect. You say, well, he's not the sinner. He's just one of millions and billions of sinners. But I think this is simply emphasizing, you see, this point, that the tax collector isn't looking at other people. He isn't in the business of comparing himself with the moral performance of others, because he knows, you see, that to do that is merely to engage in self-deception. It's merely to lull oneself into a false sense of security. And that was the very trap that the Pharisee had fallen into. He was lulling himself into a false sense of security. And perhaps you're doing that tonight, by comparing yourself to other people, by picking out those whom you know have done outwardly more disgraceful things than you've ever done in your life. And so you're picking on them, you're honing in on them, and you're comparing yourself with them, rather than measuring yourself against the law of God. That's one reason why the Pharisee had such a different self-evaluation. He was comparing himself with other people. But the other reason he had such a different self-evaluation is because his focus was upon external acts. It was upon external acts. Look how he ends his prayer. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. Now, fasting twice a week is no small matter. And tithing everything you've got is no small matter. And it's not difficult to see how this Pharisee was thinking. It's not difficult to see how his mind was working. It's not difficult to understand his logic. There he was, in the midst of hunger pangs, having for several hours once again deprived himself of food. And it's not difficult to understand how in that situation he would begin to feel, well, I'm a pretty virtuous chap. What a man I am. Or there he is, and he's studying his bank statement that has just come through the post. And he's seeing the sizable chunk that has left his bank account and gone to all kinds of charitable causes, or has gone to the church, or whatever it might be. And again, it's not difficult to imagine him swelling with pride. Well, that's pretty impressive, isn't it? To see all that money having gone from my account. I could have kept it to myself, but I've given it away. And again, perhaps You're tempted to think a little bit like that. Perhaps you're someone who gives regularly to charities. Perhaps you're someone who gives up your weekends for voluntary work to really good causes. And again, it's a way of feeling really quite good about yourself. Look at what I'm doing. Look at these things that I'm involved in. But the problem with this is that, you see, God isn't interested in external acts in and of themselves. Fasting, for instance, that has absolutely no value whatsoever. It's utterly pointless. It's utterly meaningless unless it's used simply as an aid to pray to God and to seek God's face more fervently and more earnestly and with more desire. Take giving, tithing, sacrificing your worldly resources. Again, it's utterly meaningless. It's without any value whatsoever, unless it's done as an expression of your appreciation of the grace and mercy of God that you have personally experienced. But you see, all of that was lost on this Pharisee. He was simply focusing on external acts. And perhaps tonight, as I say, you're in that situation. You are being bedazzled tonight by all your impressive-looking good works. So that's the first question. Why did the Pharisee have such a different self-evaluation? But the second question, what were the implications of this self-evaluation? So the tax collector then, he had arrived at this assessment of himself. I'm a sinner. But what did that mean? What were the implications of it? Well, in a word, a great sense of unworthiness. A great sense of unworthiness. It's there, isn't it, in all of his body language in verse 13. He's standing at a distance. He won't even look up to heaven. He's beating his breast, a culturally appropriate expression of unworthiness, felt unworthiness. He feels himself profoundly unfit for the presence of God. He feels himself deserving only of God's rejection. He feels himself utterly unacceptable to his Maker. He feels himself devoid of any reason, any explanation, any argument why God should show him any favor whatsoever. And so I'm saying then that here is this tax collector. And in his self-evaluation, we see the Christian's self-evaluation. And I'm saying then that the Christian is somebody who doesn't compare himself with other people. The relative moral performances of other people are irrelevant to the Christian. He doesn't compare himself with other people, and neither does he focus on external acts that he has performed. And the Christian, therefore, evaluates himself as a sinner. And because a sinner, somebody who is utterly unfit and unworthy of heaven and of God. I wonder, is that your self-evaluation tonight? Now you may say that sounds very bleak and very grim. But Jesus once compared the entry point to the Christian life as a narrow gate. That's how he described it. A turnstile, if you like. It's a turnstile that you can't squeeze through with your pride and your self-esteem still intact. That has to go. It's tight getting through there. You can't go through that turnstile with all your boasts and with all your claims and with all your self-image. That has to be divested. That has to be jettisoned. It's a narrow gate. The gate that gives you entrance to the Christian life. Do you have the self-evaluation tonight of the tax collector? Do you see yourself as before God a sinner? Third thing that emerges from this passage is the Christian's desire. The Christian's desire. What is the Christian's desire? Well, in a word, it's mercy. It's very obvious, very explicit, isn't it? There in verse 13. God have mercy on me, a sinner. That's what he wants. That's what he is appealing for. Mercy. I just want to mention three things that he's not desiring, that aren't the desire of the tax collector, and that aren't the desire, therefore, of the Christian. First thing, his desire isn't for commendation. You see, that was the desire of the Pharisee, wasn't it? He comes to God, telling God all that he is and all that he has done. He's wanting God's commendation, God's endorsement. He's wanting God's stamp of approval. He's wanting God to say, wow, you're amazing. He's coming to God saying, God, look at me and express your approval of me. That's the Pharisee's desire. His desire is for commendation. That's not the tax collector's desire. Secondly, his desire isn't for a higher and improved self-evaluation. His desire isn't that he might have a better self-image, that he might be more able to look away from the bad things he's done and concentrate on the good things he's done in his life. His desire isn't that he might be able to exorcise these demons that are haunting him and keep pointing him to all the mistakes he's made. I want to think more positively. I want to think better of myself. That's not his desire. His desire isn't for a higher self-esteem. And thirdly, his desire isn't primarily, and in the first instance, to live a better life from now on, to clean up his life, and to improve, and to be less of a sinner in the future. That, in the first instance, is not his desire. No, his desire is for mercy. And the word literally means something like, God, be appeased toward me. Or God, remove your anger from me. There's a definite sense of anger and wrath and God's profound disapproval involved in this word. He's asking for God to lift his anger. For God to remove and clear his anger from him. You see, he understood that because he's a sinner, because, as we've been saying, that's his self-evaluation, because he is someone who has fallen short of God's requirements and defied his Maker, he understands that because of that, God's anger is directed toward him. God isn't indifferent to the fact he's a sinner. God is angry about that. God is angry with him. He understands that. And he understands that that is his greatest problem in life. His greatest problem isn't the fact that no one likes him because he's a tax collector. His greatest problem is that God is angry with him because he's a sinner. And this then is his burning desire. This is the desire above all desires for this man. That God's anger should be removed from him. Imagine you're on a boat on the Tyne and you're going along and you see a man who is in the river. He's in the water. And he's clearly not out for a recreational swim because he's got all his clothes on. And there's something else. This man is in the path of the DFDS ferry that is coming toward him. Now, as you go past that man, or as you approach him, he's not going to be shouting out to you, "Excuse me, could you get me some fish and chips? Or could you get me an ice cream?" That's not going to be the burning desire in his heart and in his mind at that particular moment, is it? He's going to be shouting, "Get me out of here. Rescue me. Lift me out of this water before that ferry comes." That is going to be his desire, because he understands that his great danger, his great need at that point, is to be rescued from the oncoming ferry. And similarly then, that's what the Christian understands, that his great danger, his great problem in life, is that God is angry with him because he's disobeyed God. He's defied God. He's shaken his fist in God's face numerous times. And his great need, therefore, is to be delivered from that. It's for the anger to be removed. Now, perhaps you think, well, isn't this a bit unrealistic? On what basis is this going to happen? How, through praying this prayer, is this going to happen? Is God's anger going to be removed? Is this just a wishful thinking kind of desire that this man has? Well, no, it's not, because you see, this man who told the story, who told this parable, Jesus, he didn't just tell stories and tell parables like this one. But when you read on in the Gospels, whether Luke's Gospel or the other Gospels, later on, after he'd finished telling parables, finished teaching, finished talking, finished speaking, he did something else. He died. And he died on a cross. And it wasn't an ordinary death. It wasn't even an ordinary crucifixion. It was a death, the Bible makes very clear, died under the anger of God. God was angry with him. God treated him as a sinner and vented his anger against him on that cross. And yet he wasn't there under the anger of God because he deserved it. He had done nothing to provoke the anger of God. On the contrary, he had done everything to attract God's approval and God's blessing and God's favor. Jesus had lived a perfect life. He had lived an absolutely impeccable life. But you see, he was there bearing God's anger as a substitute in the place of other people, in the place of those who did deserve it, in the place of those who have sinned and have provoked the anger of God. And that means that this isn't an unrealistic desire that the Christian has. When the Christian cries out to God, "Have mercy on me, remove your anger from me," he is effectively saying the same thing as, "Count Jesus' death instead of mine. Let Jesus, who died 2,000 years ago, be my substitute. Count his experience of your anger, God, on that day when he hanged on the cross, instead of my experience of it ever in the future." And that's what faith is. We talk a lot as Christians about faith. I've mentioned it often tonight. Gigi and many of us exercising faith in Jesus Christ. That's what faith is. Faith. And this is important. Faith is more than simply the self-evaluation stage. Faith is more than simply coming to the conclusion, "I'm a sinner." That's not faith. That's a necessary step to faith. That's not faith. Faith is this desire. Is this desire that Christ's death on the cross should count instead of my eternal death when I finally come to meet God on the day of judgment. That's faith. It's that desire for mercy, that desire that God's anger be removed via the cross of Jesus Christ. So is that your desire? Is that your desire tonight? It's the most important question of all. Do you understand yourself, because a sinner, to be the object of God's anger, and in massive need, therefore, of the removal of that anger? And is it your desire then that anger should be removed through what Christ did 2,000 years ago? That's faith. That's my prayer, that all of you will tonight possess, as you leave here, or at least very soon, that desire that Christ should stand in your place as your substitute, having borne your anger in your place. One other thing as we close. The Christian's privilege. We've seen the Christian's background, the Christian's self-evaluation, the Christian's desire, fourthly and finally, the Christian's privilege. What is then the Christian's privilege? Well, verse 14, I tell you that this man, i.e. the tax collector, rather than the other, went home justified. He went home justified. That's the Christian's privilege, as it was the tax collector's privilege, to go home justified. What does that word mean? Well, it basically just means accepted with God. To be in a right relationship with God. God having no more issues with you. The relationship between him and you to be unclouded. In other words, the anger has been removed. The prayer has been answered. The anger has gone. God harbors no more anger toward this man and toward the Christian. God is no longer angry with that person. That's what it means to be justified. And that is the Christian's privilege then. The Christian can go to bed at night knowing that God isn't angry with him or her for all the sins that he or she has committed. Can get up in the morning knowing God isn't angry. Even though I've committed so many sins, God isn't angry. I'm justified. I'm accepted. I have a right relationship with him. And it's an immediate privilege. The man went home justified. Now notice, he did have to go home. When we become Christians, we're not immediately transported to heaven. We have to go home. We have to live lives in this world. We have to live Christian lives in the midst of a difficult and painful world until God ordains that we should be transported to heaven. We have to go home, but we go home justified. That moment that we first have this desire for the anger of God to be removed, that moment we first cry out, have mercy on me. From that moment of faith, from that moment we have this privilege of an absolutely cloudless relationship with God. And I just want to challenge you then, is there anything better than that tonight? Is there anything better than a happy and harmonious relationship with the God who made you and the God before whom one day you will stand and give an account? Is there anything better than that? Is winning millions of pounds in the lottery better than having a peaceful, harmonious, untroubled relationship with God? Is being the captain of today's Premiership winners, Manchester United, better than being at peace with God? How can it be? Surely there's nothing that surpasses this. You might have an ordinary life, a mundane life, a difficult life. But if you've got this, what more could you want? If you've got peace with God, if you know that whatever else happens to you in life, God is never going to come down on you like a ton of bricks. God is never going to inflict upon you the consequences of your sins. What could be better than that? I urge you tonight, if you've never yet done what Gigi has done, what so many of us have done, and placed your faith in Jesus Christ, you must do it tonight. You must do it as soon as possible. Your background is irrelevant. But you are a sinner. Understand that tonight. You're a sinner. And your desire should be for this more than anything else. To have mercy from God, his anger removed. And the moment that you do indeed have that desire, it will be removed and you will be right with God. And when you stand before him, you will stand before him as your father and your friend and one who has no condemnation at all for you. Amen.